believe we are up to Perek Dalid. Correct? Yes. We are up to Perek Dalid. All right. Like many stories in Tanakh that have a geographical bias, they are much easier to understand when we have a map in front of us. So we've got the big map behind me, which you cannot see on the recorded version of this year. I'm sorry. But that is a copy of the map. It's just a cross-section of the center of the country. If you look at the far right of the map, yeah, you'll see the Dead Sea, Yam HaMelech, and the far left, Yam HaGadol, Mediterranean, and in between is Israel, of course. Yerushalayim is almost just east of the center of the map. You see that? Mm-hmm. And that sort of gives you your geographic cross-reference to where this map, what section of the country this map is a cross-section of. Yerushalayim in the east of center, Hebron south and a little bit southwest of Yerushalayim. If you go north of Yerushalayim, due north, you'll get to Beit El. And then if you continue due north from Beit El, you'll get to Shiloh. How are you? Good. Not the problem. So we're starting Perek Dalid, and this map will sort of give us a general guideline of where we are as we read the story. So as we generally do with most of these chapters, we're going to read through first, get a sense of what went on, and then we'll come back and look at it piece by piece. Starting from the beginning of the Perek, Vayhi Devar Shmuel L'chol Yisrael. That phrase we spoke about. The word of Shmuel to all of Israel is a dispute, a discussion, a machloket in the commentaries as to whether or not it refers to the previous perek or the subsequent perek. Meaning, is it a reference to that the events which are about to take place are a fulfillment of the nevuah of Shmuel of the previous perek, Rambag, Radak, or whether it's a reference to Rashi, actually, or whether it's a reference to the introduction to the next parak, meaning this was the instruction to Israel, to them to go out to war, which some of the Mepharshim say, but is complicated. We're going to start the story from the pause, the break, in the middle of that pasuk, and look at what took place. Vayetzei Yisrael likrat plishtim lemelchama. Meaning, who started this war? Israel. Sounds like Israel started this war, right? Vayitzei Yisrael likrat plishtim. Israel went out to war against the plishtim. Which is possible that Israel decided to start this war. On the other hand, you could very easily mount the argument that the first part of this battle, which is the incursion of the plishtim northward, is not in the text, because the text starts from the part of the story where things got complicated. Right? That part of the story, which is earlier background, is less our issue. And you can see from the next phrase, "Vayachanu al ha'even ha'ezer uflishtim chanu ba'afek." They encamped at Even Ha'ezer. The plishtim encamped at Afek. Ground zero for this battle is, if you look at the map, northwest corner.
Is there a difference between Vayachan Al and Be?
Is there a difference between?
Israel are Al and Ezer, Kishim are Be Afek.
Maybe one could be a valley, one could be a hill. Don't know.
seems but like that's quite possible because that's where the hill country ends and the valley starts and the Shela starts.
Maybe. It could be. I'd have to look at it a little bit. I mean, if you look it up over here, you can see the boats really in the valley. Ebenezer and Afik are really in there. It's in mm-hmm. this yellow area, which is, remember, in this map, which is a fairly good depiction of this whole period of time, the Sefer Shoftim, the orange is Israelite settlement territory, the yellow is Canaanite Plishtim. So the Plishtim are, generally speaking, the Plishtim are down here, Gerar, Eglon, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Gat, Ekron, Eretz Plishtim. Shevet Dan, Shimshon, story of Shimshon and the Plishtim, that's here. You remember Tzor'ah, Eshta'ol, sort of right at the edge. You move further north, Afek and Ebenezer. Ebenezer is, Mefarshim all point out that at this point in time, this place is not called Ebenezer. It's called Ebenezer 7 chapters later, when Shmuel launches a counter-offensive against the Plishtim and is victorious 20 years or whatever number of years later, calls the place of the battle the stone of our deliverance, Eben HaEzer. Mm-hmm. And so it's referred to here as Eben HaEzer because that's what it will eventually be referred to, but that's just what they're calling Nikra al Shem Sofo. We know it in hindsight as a certain name. You have it very often in Tanakh. Yaakov, Avram Avinu comes to a place in between Ai and Betel, pitches his tent, calls it Betel. Yaakov Avinu comes to a place, calls it Betel. The Meraglim come to a place, come to Nachal Eshkol, they take the Eshkolot of grapefruits and they call the place Nachal Eshkol. Right. So there's constant references to these places where we know them by a certain name. In hindsight, the story refers to them that way at the beginning, and then at some point or another in the story, we find out why that name was applicable. But in this case, if you look geographically, here's Shiloh, right? Yerushalayim north to Shiloh, and west of Shiloh along the coast is Ebenezer Afek. If you look at the map, this is Tel Aviv today, Shevet Dan. North is you can see on this map where Yafo is listed. So further Lud, further north along the coast. Not quite as I don't think it's quite as this is Tel Aviv, so it's a little bit further north. Okay. Vayachu plishtim likrat Yisrael. If let's go back one phrase. If Israel started this war, started this campaign, why did they do so? What possible motivation would Israel have had for starting up with the known and dangerous adversary known as the Plishtim? But it say Israel likrat Plishtim. Why would they have done so? Meaning. Usually the Plishtim are down here. But by this point, if the battlefield is over here by Afek, that means that the Plishtim are on the move. Right, this is Eretz Plishtim, down here in the south. So near what we would call today the area of here's Gaza. Just north of Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, that corridor. If they're sitting in Afek and Ebenezer, that means that they have moved much further north than is typical, and that may have posed for Israel an existential threat. And so they chose to respond to that existential threat, at which point the question of who started the war is irrelevant. Right? The other possibility is that they're not only have they incurred farther north than they typically would, but there's another danger of the Plishtim sitting in Afek, that Israel was not prepared to just let go by without a response, and that would be
it's closer to Shiloh.
Right, and that would be the proximity to Shiloh. So you have both a strategic threat of the Plishtim being that far north, as well as a sort of national threat, or the sense of danger that the Plishtim pose to the proximity to Shiloh. In either case, they decide to go to war. The Plishtim gathered their forces against Israel. Vatitosh hamilchama vayinagef Yisrael lifnei Plishtim. The battle begins to unfold. Vayinagef Yisrael lifnei Plishtim in Israel. Vayinagef. Magefa. Smitten, plague, defeated. Vayinagef Yisrael lifnei Plishtim. Israel met defeat. They lost that campaign. Vayakub ha-maracha basadeh ka'arbat alafim ish. Approximately 4,000 Israelites died on the battlefield that day. That in of itself isn't necessarily a large number, as we'll see soon. But it does, remember, this is just that one moment's campaign. That campaign ended in defeat, 4,000 were killed, they retreated, and now they're going to regroup for the next campaign. So the war is not over, that particular campaign ended in defeat, and 4,000 were killed. They gathered together, regroup at base camp. Vayamru Ziknei Yisrael. What is Ziknei Yisrael? The elders, the Shoftim, the 70 elders of the Sanhedrin, perhaps. Right? Perhaps the elders in terms of the military leaders. Vayamru Ziknei Yisrael. Lama negafanu Hashem hayom lifnei plishtim. Why have we been defeated? Why did God smite us or allow us to be smitten in the hands of the plishtim? What's the question? The question isn't why we militarily, what weakness we had militarily in this campaign that allowed us to be defeated by the plishtim. What's really the question? And they say it. It's a theological issue. We're fighting God's battle for the defense of Israel, for the protection of Shiloh. We're fighting God's battle. Lama Hashem nigafanu Hashem ayom lifnei plishtim. Why did God let us be defeated in the hands of the plishtim? We need a solution. We need an alternative. This, by the way, is not the first time that they've met defeat in the battlefield. Right.
But back in Yehoshua, when even one person was killed, they recognized that it was because of a spiritual or some type of theological failing within themselves.
You'd hope, right?
That's what I, yeah.
In Yehoshua, that's true. But I think for Yehoshua, that's true. Yeah, for Shoftim, less so.
Yeah, look how far we've come.
400 years later, correct?
Yeah, not so far long, but long
right.
enough.
I mean, it doesn't take more than one generation now, if this is 350 years later, but correct, 100%. Right. At the end of the Battle of Ai, they lose the first campaign of the Battle of Ai, whatever it is, 36 people were killed. Yehoshua goes running back to God. How dare you? How could you? What did we do wrong? Why did you? So what does God tell him? There's a problem. Go fix the problem, and we'll find a we'll do this again. Problem of Achan, the other problems there, but essentially Hashem identifies for him what the issues were, and they go back and they fix it. Here, first of all, God doesn't answer them. If you want to compare it to Ai, the comparison is unfair, because in Ai, they lose the first campaign, but they win the war. Here, they lose the first campaign, and they lose the war. God is not answering them.
Did they ask?
That is an interesting question. Did they ask? Did they ask to go out to war in the first place? Who's leading them in this battle? That's a fair and important question. Who's leading them in this battle? In one of the previous source pages, I showed you the Ramban, not the Ramban, the Machloket Rashi and Radak, as to whether or not they sought God's counsel in this war. I think it's Radak or the Rambag, one of them, who says that the reason why they lost this first campaign was because they went to war without seeking God's counsel. They didn't seek the Umvatumim, they didn't go to the Navi, they have a Navi, Shmuel, they have a Kohen Gadol, they didn't seek any of their advice, they just went. In all cases, God doesn't answer them. So they have a solution. I'm not sure they really asked in the sense of asking the way we would expect Yeshua to go to the Kohen Gadol or the Navi. Or I think that this was more of almost a rhetorical question. Woe is to us that God has allowed us to be defeated. There's a problem. Let's find a solution. What's the solution? Nikcha elenu mishilo et aron brit Hashem v'yavo b'kirbenu v'yoshienu mekafavenu. Let's take the Aron Brit Hashem, the Ark of the Covenant of God, that's there in Shiloh. We're near Shiloh, it's in proximity, it's not that far. Maybe they're even defending to protect Shiloh, unclear. And Aron Brit Hashem, we'll take that Aron Brit Hashem and let it come in our midst, we'll take it into battle. And let God save us from our enemies. What's the implication? We'll see. Momentarily, we'll digress to all discussion halachically whether or not this was an exceptional circumstance, but they certainly saw it was an exceptional circumstance, that they were going to take the Aron into battle. What hint is there in this verse that would indicate to us that why that, in their mindset, why that was a possible solution? Meaning?
Meaning he'll be with us this time. Hashem will be with us, and therefore we won't be defeated.
Hashem will be with us, we won't be defeated. Maybe we were defeated because we lacked God's presence. We'll take God's presence into battle, less likely to be defeated. Let's bring God a little closer. Maybe he's too far away. Maybe he needs to be a little bit more in proximity to the battle to be able to save us. Okay, fair argument.
But isn't that like a little hint of idolatry, of Avodah Zarah? Because
A little.
You know, Hashem's presence is not only with the Aron.
True, but the Aron was very powerful. I mean, the Aron was very powerful. There certainly was a sense of the Shechina, the Aron, the Shechina dwelt. What do we call the Aron? We call the Aron Aron Brit Hashem Yoshev HaKruvim, a God who dwells between the Kruvim. Mm-hmm. There is a sense that the Aron is the presence of God, that the Shechina is in the Aron. So maybe a little bit too tangible, but there is such a concept. Not only is there such a concept, there's actually such a precedent.
Mm-hmm. Oh, when later okay. on?
No, there's a precedent. I'm not sure that they're thinking of this precedent. I'm not sure that they're that sophisticated. But there is a precedent for the notion that success or defeat in the battlefield is dependent upon the presence of the Aron as a way of carrying God's name into the battlefield. There is a precedent.
When?
If you look at the Battle of Amalek with Yeshua and Moshe, when they were spiritually looking for Hashem, they were more victorious when they weren't. So maybe that's what they're for.
Maybe. That's already very sophisticated.
When they carry the Aron around the city of
They used the Aron in the Battle of Ai, in the Battle of Jericho. True. But I'm looking for a much more direct parallel, where the sense of the presence of the Aron in the battlefield is an indicator as to whether they will succeed or fail. And because they failed, they assumed it was because they lacked the Aron with them. It's a very obscure place, a verse, and I'm not convinced in my mind that they understood this connection. For us and for our discussion in a few minutes, it will become very important. Anybody know where this reference to the success or failure in the battlefield depended upon the presence of the Ara? There's something to be said for that, but a much more direct parallel.
Of an actual event?
Mm-hmm. And sometimes there are stories in Chumash that we are so familiar with, but there's these little references, obscure references, that get glossed over because we don't realize the context of and the implication of what they refer to. So this is a really good example. Take a look at Bamidbar Perek Yud Dalet. Remember the story of the spies?
Yeah.
So there's several parts of the story of the spies. One, of course, they send the spies come back, they come back with a failed report. Then God gets angry at them and he decrees that they're going to spend 40 years in the desert. And then he punishes the spies by killing the actual Meragim. The actual Meragim die in a Magefa, correct? Mm-hmm. Take a look at the end of Perek Yudalid, Bamidbar Yudalid, starting with Pasuk Lamem. After the Magefa that kills, the plague that kills the 10 spies who spoke evil about Israel. Vayashkimu baboker, vayalu avoshahar, lemor. The next day they got up, they went up to the top of the mountain, and they proclaimed, Hinenu v'alinu ala makom asher amar Hashem, ki chatanu. Let's go, says the group. Okay, we sinned. We made a mistake. You're right, Moshe. Terrible. This is post the calamity. Post the Xera 40 years. Post the Magefa that kills the Meraglim. They wake up in the morning with a reality check. It's a choice between following God into Israel or spending 40 years in the desert. So a little bit too little, too late. They come to Moshe and they said, okay, Moshe, we're ready to go. Vayomer Moshe, lama ze atem ovrim et pi Hashem, vi lo titzlach, says Moshe. We're not going anywhere. This is a doomed to failure mission. We are not going anywhere. Al talu, don't go up. Ki en Hashem bekirbechem. God is not in your midst. Velot tinagfu lifna evechem. You should not be defeated. You will not. If you go up, you'll be defeated. So don't go up because you. If you want to avoid being defeated, being smitten, then stay home. Ki ha'amaleki v'aknani sham lifnechem. You go up now, you're going to meet head on with the Amalek and the Canaanites. Unefaltem b'cherav. You will fall by the sword. Ki alken shavtem me'achvei Hashem v'lo yeh Hashem imachem. You have turned away from God, therefore God will not be in your midst. Vayapilu la'alot el roshaha. Vayapilu means, as we call this parasha, the ma'apilim. Right? They
stubborn,
and they go up anyway. Vayapilu la'alot el roshaha. Va'aron brit Hashem u'moshe lomashu mikerav ha'machane. They went up, Moshe and the Aaron didn't move. And the Amalekites came down and they smit them and they destroyed them. So, what does it mean that Moshe and the Aaron didn't move? Why would the Aaron have moved? So on the one hand, you could say that the whole camp moved with the Aaron. When the Aaron moved, the camp moved. So if the camp's not moving, it's because the Aaron's staying put. That's an indication that they're not, that the whole camp isn't going. But if you're looking for a precedent for the sense of the Aaron Berit Hashem to accompany them on a successful mission, or to be the litmus test of success, in the variable that's missing in the failure, and therefore the variable they need to change in order to be successful, There is some precedent for it. Aron Brit Hashem was missing, therefore the Mapilim failed. So the people come back from this failed attempt to fight the Plishtim, just geographically not too far off. And they said, okay, we're missing, what are we missing? The Aron Brit Hashem, it's the exact same phrase. The Aron Brit Hashem. Pasuk Dalet.
It wasn't usual for them to take the Aron?
That is the huge question.
That's been bothering me.
That is the biggest question in this discussion. That's going to take us a couple of weeks to sort out. Okay. The question of questions in this parak is, was it normal or was it abnormal? And if it was abnormal, then what made them think they could do it? If it was normal, then what did they do wrong? That is the question. It's different opinions in the commentaries. It's a difference. There are different opinions in Chazal, in the Midrashim. There's actually a difference between the Bavli and the Rishalmi. It's a major piece. That's what the source page is all about. So Mizrat Hashem will get there. But that is the question. Pasuk Dalet. Vayishlach ha'am Mishilo. Where is the Aron Brit Hashem?
In Shiloh.
So they sent messengers to Shiloh. Vayisu misham et Aron Brit Hashem Tzvaot Yoshev Akruvim. That's the phrase. They take out the Aron Brit Hashem, the covenant, the Aron that contained the covenant of God of hosts, Aron Brit Hashem Tzvaot, God who dwells between the Kruvim, Yoshev Akruvim. V'sham Shnei V'nei Eli Im Aron Brit Elokim Chofni U'Finchas. Who carried the Aron? Our old two friends.
Two suspects.
Our old friends. Chafni Pinchas. Vayi kivo Aron Brit Hashem. El machane, count how many times the Aron is referred to as Aron Brit Hashem. When the Aron Brit Hashem came into the camp, Vayariu ko Yisrael to Agdola. Vatehom ha'aretz. What does Vayariu mean?
They cheered.
They cheered. They cried out. They made a lot of noise. Laharia is to make a lot of noise. Same root as Tru'a. Right. Hashem Elokav imo utru'at melech bo. Why do they make a lot of noise?
They were acknowledging the presence of Hashem in the
Aron. They were cheering the Aron. Possible. Hey, God comes, cheer. That's possible. One possibility. Another possibility. It's more than just a cheer.
Some kind of prayer.
Where has the Aron been used in battle before? This Aron.
In Yericho.
Yericho. Correct? And Yericho, if you remember the story, they had to go around with their trumpets. Mm-hmm. Right? They had to go around, and on the seventh day, when the walls were going to fall down, what did they do? They took, and who led that march around the walls of Yericho? The Kohanim carrying the Aron. Take a look back in Yeshua Perek Vav. Starting with Pasuk Yud Bet. Vayashkem Yehoshua baboker, vayisu ha-kohanim et Aron Hashem. The Kohanim led by carrying the Ark. V'shiva Kohanim nosim v'shiva shofot ha-yovlim lifnei Aron Hashem. Seven Kohanim with seven shofarot, walking. Excuse me, before the Aron. ותקעו בשופרות, והחלוץ הולך לפניהם, והמאסף הולך אחרי ארון השם, הולך ותקע בשופרות. There's a group before the Aaron, there's a group behind the Aaron, the Aaron's in the middle, and what are they doing, these group of Kohanim, before and behind, in front and behind? They are blowing shofarot. Surround the city once, they said the second day, and third day, 6 days, and then on the seventh day, Pasuk Kedva, Vayi b'yom ha-shvi'i, Vayashkimu kalot ha-shacha, Vayasobu et ha'ir kemishpat hazeh shev pamim, 7 times they surround the city exactly as they did this before. And that day only they circled 7 times. Pasuk Tedzayin, Vayi b'pam ha-shvi'it. On the 7th circuit, taku ha-konim b'shofarot, they began to blow the shofar, Vayomer Yeshua el ha'am, how are you? Kinatan Hashem et ha'ir. What does it mean, la'aria? Make a lot of noise. And between the city, between the noise and the Kohanim and the Aron and the Shofarot, the earthquake hit and the walls crumbled. So here is the second time take a simple reading of the story, which is that this is only the second time they've actually taken the Aron Brit Hashem out of the Kodesh HaKodeshim to lead them into battle. They see it, they hear it, Vayariyu Yisrael Tu Agdolah, Vatehom Ha'aretz. Everybody's confounded, they're confused. There's a mass transformation that's taking place. The camp of Israel has been transformed because new energy, new inspiration, new focus, all because
the
Aron. The Aron. Pasuk Vav. Vayishmu plishtim et kol ha'tru'ah. What are the plishtim here? Remember, they're across the valley. So the plishtim are in Afek. The Israelites are in Ebenezer. One's in the hill, one's in the valley, or they're across the valley. They heard this great tumult. It's a good fancy word. They heard the tumult. Vayomru. Met kol ha'tru'ah gdola hazot b'machaneh ha'ivrim. What is this noise that we hear in the camp of the Ivrim? The use of the term Ivrim here is very important and very interesting. It comes up in a number of places in Sefer Shmuel. I will address it as a separate subject later. Probably in Perek Yud Aleph, I believe, or Michmas. It has a particular connotation, but for now we'll just leave it as a reference to the Hebrews or the Israelites. What is this noise? Vayed'u ki Aron Hashem ba'al ha'machaneh. They knew that something changed. What changed? They brought the Aron Brit Hashem. Actually, here it's called Aron Hashem. It's interesting. It's always referred to as Aron Brit Hashem, the Ark of the Covenant with God. Here, when the Plishtim refer to it, they call it the Aron Hashem. Is that significant? I don't know, but it's interesting. Vayir'u ha-plishtim. They were afraid. Why were they afraid? They didn't play. What do they care about God? They're plishtim. They've got their own gods.
They've had prior experience.
They've had prior experience with our God?
With Shimshon.
Okay. Maybe.
Well, they heard about all the... they heard about the power of Hashem.
Maybe. They think in pagan terms, not in religious terms, right? Dealing with pagans and idolaters, you have to think in pagan terms.
They don't have their God with them.
They may have their gods with them, but it's still something to be afraid of. Right? This is not a God you treat lightly. Right? This is already playing with fire. Ki yomru ba Elohim el ha-machaneh. God has come into the battlefield. Now they're frightened. Vayomru further said, Right? It's the same group of people. So anytime you see Vayiru, Vayamru, Vayamru, it's the same people. They're just, this is the conversation that's spreading. Oilanu. Kilai takazot at Moshe Shom. Woe unto us. This is different. This isn't how it's been yesterday, the day before. This is not the kind of skirmishes and battles we've had with the Israelites before. We know how to deal with the Israelites, especially on the coast. Don't forget, they haven't gone into the hills yet. They're on the coast. Canaanites, Plishtim, the ancient indigenous populations, they had horses and chariots. They stayed on the coast. They had the upper hand on the coast. They know how to deal with the Israelites before. This is different. Oilanu. Now listen to the next phrase. Woe unto us. Mi yatzilenu miyad ha-Elohim ha-adirim ha-ele. Who is going to save us from the hands of these strong gods? I will read that again. Mi yatzilenu miyad ha-Elohim ha-adirim ha-ele. Elehem ha-Elohim ha-makim et Mitzrayim b'chom makah b'midbar. These are the gods that smote the Egyptians. These are the gods that smote in the Midbar and the plagues in the desert. Right? This is not something you play games with. This is the real stuff. These are the gods that smote Israel, that smote the Egyptians. These are the gods responsible for the plagues of Egypt. You understand? So what do you do when you're faced with such a powerful enemy or enemies? Hitchazku. This is the speech to the Plishtim, right? This is the speech to the... Hitchazku. This is the Musa Shmuz, right? The pep talk. What? The halftime, yeah. Hitchazku. V'yula anashim Plishtim. Plishtim. Be a man. Be men. Don't be wimps. Pentavdula Ivrim. What do you want to be, slaves to the slaves? You want to be slaves to the Hebrews? Kasher Avdulachem, like they were slaves to you? Vitem la Nashim. Stand up and fight like men. Menilchamtem. Let's see. Who's going to be afraid? Oilanu. Oilanu. The Plishtim are crying. On to us. Twice. What an expression. Twice. Oilanu. You understand, of course, that it's not the same group of people speaking here. This conversation has gone from one group of people to another. Otherwise, it makes no sense at all. It's not the same people saying, woe unto us, woe unto us, who's going to save us? Be strong, be strong. That's not the same people's thing. This is the conversation taking place in the camp of the Plishtim. They see the Aron, frightened out of their wits. They hear the noise. They hear the change in attitude of the Israelites. So their immediate response is, they're afraid. Woe unto us. We're done. We're doomed. We're finished. We can't fight these gods. And then, Pasuk Tet, Hitchazku. That's a response. So the people, the masses, the amcha, if you will, right, are they're afraid until the leaders, the generals, the leaders of the army turn to them and say, enough, you wimps. Now it's time to fight like men. Hitchazku. Yula anashim plishtim. What, do you want to be servants? You want to give up and be slaves to the Hebrews, to the Israelites? Penta avdula ivrim? Eventually, when we study the word ivrim, we'll see how pejorative that statement really is. We're slaves to slaves. Pasuk Yud. Vayilachamu plishtim. They fought, and they fought well. Vayinagfu Yisrael. Israel was defeated. Vayanusu ish le'olav. And they ran home. But this time they didn't run back to the camp and regroup. Right, like they did last time. Vayavo ha'amal ha'machaneh. Vayanusu ish le'olav. Vatiya makah gdola me'od. Terrible devastation. Vayipol mi'Yisrael 30,000 ragli. 30,000 were killed at that battle. If in the first day they lost 4,000, then they went to grab the Aron, took it into camp, now they lost another 30,000. Va'aron elokim nilkach. and the Aron was taken captive. Ushne bnei Eli metu chofni ufinchas. Two sons of Eli who carried the Aron were killed, executed, chofni ufinchas. The rest of this story is the report back to Eli, changes shifts away from the battlefield back to the palace of Eli. We'll talk about that another time. But I want one more question before we begin to really explore this story in earnest, and that is that there is a remarkably problematic phrase in this parak. We need to understand it in order to understand what's going on in this whole story. When the plishtim respond to the presence of the ark, what do they say?
It's in a plural form.
Correct. Oy lanu, mi yatzilenu miyad ha-Elohim ha-adimim ha-ele. These powerful gods. Ele hem ha-Elohim ha-makim et Mitzrayim b'chol makam ha-midbar. These are the gods of Israel who smote Egypt and the desert. Why is it in the plural? Right. So technically, Elohim is always plural. Technically, Elohim is a plural noun. And therefore, if you think about the way it's conjugated in Tanakh, anytime it's Kodesh, and we refer to God as Elohim, it's always conjugated in the singular. Vayomer Elohim, Vayivra Elohim. Vayeda Elohim, Vayishma Elohim. It's a singular conjugation, even though Elohim is a plural noun. El, it means power. Eloah, deity. Elohim, technically, is a plural noun, which is problematic. When it is conjugated in Chumash to refer to idols or false gods or other gods, consistently, it is referred to as, or is conjugated as, a plural. Lo yelecha Elohim acherim al panai. Other gods. Small g, plural. And hence it's not Kodesh, it's Chol, Elohim. So from the perspective of Tanakh, anytime you refer to God as Hashem Elohim, it's in this, even though it's a plural noun, it's in the singular, but it is a plural noun. When you refer to it from a perspective of as we refer to other gods or other deities, we talk about Elohim Acharim. This is one of the few places where we find, in fact, I'm not sure it's the only place, but it's certainly one of the rare places where we find the pagans or the idolaters using the term Elohim to refer to our God. And now its conjugation in the plural is problematic. Understand? Aron Brit Hashem, Tzvaot, Yoshev HaKruvim. Can you refer to Hashem in the plural?
Why is it problematic? It's the Plishtim.
It's from their point of view. That's the way.
So why would they? Our whole belief system is about monotheism. For hundreds of years, one Mikdash, one Mishkan, one God. Why, from the days of Abraham, why on earth would the Plishtim, know nothing about Israelites? Nothing. Why would they use a plural?
They're looking at this double statue.
Oh, so that's the other piece of the story. Is they're not referring to what are the Plishtim looking at? They're looking at the Aron. And we just have to remember what the Aron looks like. The Aron Brit, it's described at the beginning of the story. Aron Brit Hashem Tzvaot Yoshev HaKruvim. So, this week's parasha, very appropriate comment for this week's parasha. We have an Aron, we have a box. Inside the box is the Luchot HaEdut or the Luchot HaBrit. Why is it referred to as?
They're in the plural too.
They're in the plural because they're referring to the Luchot.
Right.
Right to the. That's a very interesting observation. So look at the way we refer to the Aron. and the way the Plishtim refer to the Aron throughout the story, consistently. So we in throughout the story, how does Israel refer to the Aron? It's either called the Aron Brit Hashem, or the Aron Brit Hashem Tzvakot Yoshev Hakruvim. Right? How do the Plishtim refer to it as?
Aron
Hashem. And then Miyatzilena Miyada Elohim Ha'adirim Ha'ele Ele. Right, and we get the plural. So what's clear is that when we look at the Aron, what do we see? What do we see as the centerpiece, the essence of what the Aron is about?
The
Luchot. The Luchot HaBrit. The Luchot HaEdut. Correct? The essence of the Aron is that it's a box containing the Luchot HaBrit. Or the Luchot HaEdut. The Aron is referred to as the Aron HaBrit. The Aron is referred to as the Aron HaEdut. It's the box of the Brit. It's the box of the Aron of the Edut. It contains the Luchot. The essence of the Aron is what's inside it. What's inside it is the Luchot, the Torah. We refer to the Aron of the Brit with Hashem, because the Brit is what's inside. We refer to God as Yoshev HaKruvim. Why is Hashem Yoshev HaKruvim? Because here's a Kruv, and here's a Kruv. And what does the Torah tell us about the Kruvim? What do they represent? Say it again. Very, very simplistic level. What do the Kruvim represent? What does the word Kruv mean? Where is it?
Closeness.
Angel.
No. You're confusing two spellings.
I'm sorry.
Kruv is spelled with a chaf,
oh.
And close comes from the word karov, which is spelled with a kuf.
Okay.
So I have to be careful in Hebrew with spelling. But the Kruv was a kind of angel. First place that the word kruv is used in Tanakh to refer to as to refer to a malach is by Gan Eden. When after Adam and Chava are expelled from Gan Eden, God places at the entrance to Gan Eden kruvim to guard the entrance to Gan Eden. You with me? A kruv is a type of malach. What kind of malach? There are different names for malachim we refer to in Tanakh. We refer to them in the Tefillah. We say it every day in Shmona Esrei on Shabbos, every week at Shmona Esrei on Shabbos. Kedusha, my mind is slipping for a moment. But the Kruvim, the Fanin, the Chayot, these are all different types of malachim. So if you take a box, and inside this box you place the Luchot of the Brit, and atop this box you place the image of two Kruvim,
okay,
or a Malach, then what's the role of a Malach? Now you can argue it's not, you're not supposed to make pictures or images of Malachim either, but that's a gezeira of the Torah. Monotheistically, this is all problematic to put such tangible items in the presence of the Mishkan, but that's all different conversation. What's the role of a malach in this context? So the way that the malachim or the kruvim in Gan Eden guarded the entrance to Gan Eden. Remember, at the end of the story, there's only one thing left in Gan Eden, which was the Eitz Chaim, the Eitz HaDaat they took. It's the only thing left in Gan Eden. V'ata pen yishlach yado v'yachal me'etz ha'chaim v'chay li'olam. V'yasem Hashem. Hey, Pen Adam Yakha Memenu Ladat Tov Rava Pen Yishlach Dov Lakach Gam Etz Chaim V'Chal V'Chal Le'Olam. Man took the Etz Hadat, now he's going to take the Etz Chaim, will be eternal. V'Yishlachehu Hashem Elokim Gan Eden, so he expels him from Gan Eden. V'Yigarash Et Adam V'Yashken Mikedem LeGan Eden, he placed, guarding the east entrance to Gan Eden, Et HaKruvim Et La'at HaCherev HaMitapechet Lishmor Et Derech Etz HaChaim. So the image of Gan Eden is you have these Kruvim standing there with a fiery sword protecting entrance to the Eitz HaChaim. I once gave a shiur, I think it was Shavuos HaTshuva, talked about the image of the Kohen Gadol going into the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur as a return of Adam to Gan Eden. Because returning into the Kodesh HaKadoshim is essentially returning to Gan Eden. The only thing inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim is the Aron with the Brit, the Luchot HaBrit, and the Kruvim guarding it. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
What's another name for Torah?
It's
Chayim Hi Lemachazikim Ba. So you have this image of the Aron in the Kodesh HaKadoshim as the representation of Gan Eden and the Kruvim guarding and protecting it. Where is Hashem in this process? Vayehi kol Elokim mitalech bagan. Where is the Shechina? In the Gan, which means, says the Pasuk, and I showed you this Pasuk, I think, once before, Vayishmat kol Elokim midaber elav miben shnei akuvim asher al aron ha'edut asher al kaparat asher al aron ha'edut. Moshe comes into the Mishkan, he hears God's voice from where? Miben shnei akuvim, which is on the kaparot, which is on the Aron HaEdut. The notion of the place of the Shechina is that God's presence is not the Kruvim, God's presence is in between. It's in the sense of the role of the Kruvim represent. They represent the guards, they represent the guards, if you will, of Gan Eden. They represent the Malachim, the entourage of the king. It's a throne room. There's your throne. There are your guards. The Shechina is the Malach of the King of Kings. Beautiful. All works, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Aron is the Aron of Brit Hashem. It doesn't contain God. It contains the Brit of God. The Kruvim, God dwells between the Kruvim. Yoshev HaKruvim. Because God's not the Malach, the Kruv. God is in between. Right? The whole notion of the Aron is that it's a throne to the invisible God who dwells everywhere. Great. Simple question. What does a pagan plishti know about any of this? One thing for sure he didn't do is come to my Shabbos Shuvah Drash. When the pagan looks at the Aron, what do they see? They see a box carrying two golden statues.
Could they see it, though? How
could
they see it?
You think that the Kruvim are 10 tefachim high, the whole Aron is only 9 tefachim high.
Meaning?
The Kruvim are bigger than the box. It's not like
the Kruvim are, yes, the scale is off. The Kruvim are bigger than the box, right? The Iker and the Tuffel is perceived. Could they see it? I suspect they could, because I'm sure the Bnei Yisrael held it high. Right, they weren't hiding this. They're vayariu. There's a tumult. There's vatehom hamachane. Everybody's a right. And the end, it's actually they vayedu ki aron Hashem ba'al hamachane. So first of all, even the reference to calling it Aron Hashem and not Aron Brit Hashem is very interesting. It's never referred to as Aron Hashem. We said Aron Hashem. Or Aron HaBrit.
Yeah, okay, I
can see that. I can see that. First of all, I can see it in the context of Sefer Yehoshua. I can also see it in the context where if there isn't a contrasting perception. It was like a shorthand. It didn't matter as much. Whereas here, where you have this constant reference, and as we read it at the beginning, I pointed out how many times it's referred to as Arum Brit Hashem until the Plishtim get a hold of this. So it could be that there's a difference. But Arum Brit Hashem, Arum Hashem, Eile Elohim HaAdirim HaMakim Et Mitzrayim, the emphasis on the plural, these are the gods of Israel. This is the first time they are, I would argue, the very first time they've ever laid eyes on the Kruvim. Nobody's ever laid eyes on the Kruvim. When have they ever taken this Aron out of the Kodesh HaKadosh since they built the Mishkan?
Brought it into battle before, which goes
to... So we're going to come to the question of if they brought anything into battle, they certainly didn't bring this Aron into battle. And we'll talk about it.
Why are you going to such great lengths to explain that it's based on them seeing the Kruvim? Why not simply from their perception as pagans, as idol worshippers, they perceive the powers in the world to be multiple, that there's not one God? So they're just transferring their pagan belief onto what they see the Israelites bringing out. They say, oh,
this
okay,
it's
just
too
like that.
Pointed. Elohim ha-Elohim. Elohim ha-Elohim ha-Adirim ha-Eleh. Elohim ha-Elohim ha-Makim et Mitzrayim b'chol kama midbar. V'yidu ki Aron Hashem ba'al ha-Machaneh. It's all about the Aron, and they take the Aron and they capture it and they bring it back. I mean, this is all about the...
But it could just be out of ignorance of an understanding of the essence of what
maybe,
Hashem is.
Maybe,
not that they
attribute so,
something to it.
Maybe, but it's such a powerful image where they look the first time any of our enemies has ever laid eyes on this Aron, except for maybe in the early days of Yeshua. Yoshev HaKruvim, the Pasuk tells us, what is it? And of all the things to call the Aron at the beginning, not because out of its way to call it Aron Brit Hashem Tzvaot Yoshev HaKruvim. The sense of the perception of the idolatry of it, that these Kruvim represented a deity, and the Plishtim looked at the Kruvim and they said, this is the idol, this is their deity. It's no different from their deities. In fact, they're going to take the Aron. What are they going to do with it? They're going to bring it back to their palace. They're going to stick it inside their palace to Dagon and amidst the pantheon of idols. It's such a powerful image that
but
I don't think...
That could actually represent a failure of the Israelites to... Because you said before, wouldn't they understand what the Israelites' religion was? That
no,
that there was one God, and that the Jews only believed the Israelites.
I was being facetious. I don't believe for a minute that they really understood
the
Israelites.
Understand.
But even if they didn't understand, they never make such a declaration. There is no point where any of our enemies in any battlefield has ever made the declaration. You know when the only ever time that declaration has been made before? Similar declaration was by the eagle. Right? By the eagle. And the Jews made the eagle as of. When they made the golden calf, that's precisely what they said. The same phrase. Right? Not there. It's not on the well. It says Ela, but it's not clear. There, it's not on the plural. But they only made one ego. But the notion that they make this golden image and then point to it and say, "Oh, these are the gods." That's here. They don't have to make the golden image. They took the Kruvim right out of the Aron Kodesh, right out of the Aron. They brought it into the battlefield.
But the difference here, it's not that the Israelites are calling it these are the gods of Israel like they did with the Chet HaEgel, but it's the Philistines who are being misguided. Why is
well,
that a bad
I can't expect
on Israel.
Well, we haven't gotten yet to the question of what Israel were thinking, doing, saying, or perceiving. So I'll reserve comment on that side of it, but you know, at the very minimum, you take the Aron with the Kruvim out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim without permission, unasked, And you put those kruvim in the middle of this battlefield, you beg the invitation to worship what? What do they want? What do the Israelites want? What were they looking for? Right? We're not talking about loyal, religious Talmid HaChachamim here. Right? Remember what I said, we talked about last week about the idolatry of 400 years of idolatry. This was not significantly different than the rest of the pagan world at this moment in history. The whole point of the Churban was to hold them accountable for 400 years of idolatry. When Israel brought the Aron into the camp of the battlefield, what were they thinking? So maybe their perception of it was a little more subtle than the Plishtim. Maybe. But what did they say at the beginning? Nikham Elenu Mishiloat Aron Brit Hashem. Let's take the Aron out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. For what purpose? V'yavo b'kirbenu v'yoshienu mikaf oyveinu, so that God can come with us into battle and save us in the hands of the Plishtim. Right? Is that not problematic in itself? Right? They're dancing around the Aron. Exactly. They're dancing around the Aron. The perception, they can take the Aron into the battlefield and they've got God with them. Why do they have God with them? Kruvim, maybe the Kruvim, but between the Kruvim and some type of that, we can argue it. But in the end, it's very anthropomorphic. It's very physical. It's very, you know, very tangible and somewhat problematic, more than somewhat. To think that you're going to win this battle by bringing the Aron and the Kruvim into the battlefield. If there was another Aron, it didn't have Kruvim on it, by the way. If there was another Aron that they took into battle on a regular basis, it didn't have Kruvim.
What did it have in it?
What it had in it is separate. What it had in it, we'll talk about. But what it had on it is the bigger question. It did not have Kruvim. According to everybody, if there was a second Aron, it did not have Kruvim. We'll see. We'll go through the psukim for that next week with the whole story of the Aron Eitz and what happened to it. If it was there, it did not have kruvim.
It seems strange to me is that if they'd heard of Mitzrayim and they remembered it so many years later, the whole purpose of all of the otot u'moftim and all that was to give the message not only that the gods of Israel were stronger than any other gods, but that there was one God. So what happened to that message?
Well, we're 400 years later, so we see what happened to that message.
So in other words, that message got lost among...
message got lost in the shuffle.
They only remembered...
They remembered the power, they remembered the events, and now for the first time, they're seeing the Aron. Remember, this is the first time they've laid eyes on the Aron. The Jews are worshipping it. The Jews are bowing down to it, clearly. They have to be. They can't be a truma and a tahom kol machanev. They're not bowing down to this thing. I mean, if you think about it in their terms, right, they're not saying, oh, you're not allowed to look at it, you have to cover it with a trelet because you're not allowed to look at the kuv. They're not there. They're taking this thing into the middle of the camp. They're dancing around it. So if the Jews are dancing around it, what do you think the Plishtim are doing? They're watching. And the Jews are dancing around this box with two golden statues on it. I mean, it feeds right into the whole mentality. They remember anything. If they're remembering, maybe the Jews are singing. Maybe the Jews are singing Shirat Hayam. Maybe the Jews are singing Eilel Hecha Yisrael Asher Elucha Meretz Mitzrayim. Last time they had gold statues with them, that's what they sung. Who knows? But the Plishtim are standing there watching all of this and saying, half of them are getting disheartened, right? These are the gods that smote Egypt. That's a legend. We know that story. And the other half are saying, not so fast. Not so fast. Don't be such wimps. Right? What, are you afraid of two little statues? Go for it. And the result is that they're going to have a very strong lesson in theology very shortly, but this is what's going on. So the physicality of the Kruvim, I think, is at the center of this story.
So then why were there such a physical presence? That would be pretty predictable. Why were they commanded to make this?
So that's the famous question that the Mefarshim all ask in this week's parashah. Right? That's the Kuzari and Rashi and Rabban. They all struggle with the physicality of the Kruvim and ultimately come to various conclusions related to the fact that this is a gzeira, that's what Hashem wanted, you can't question God, but at the same time, you have to know it's not God. We're not creating images of God, we're creating images of the malachim, and they're hidden in the Kodesh HaKodashim, you're not allowed to look at them because you don't want to get the wrong idea. It gets complicated. Ultimately, the why, we don't know. But that's what we have. We have an image of the role of the malachim in the relationship between God and Israel. That's what the Kruvim are. But the boundary between understanding the Kruvim as a symbol of the angels and the role the malachim play as conduits of of God's will in the world, very esoteric concept, to a golden statue to be bowed down to, is a very dangerous line. And maybe that's why the Torah would not allow the average Israelite to lay eyes on the Kruvim ever. The average Jew, the average Israelite would never ever see these Kruvim. Maybe that's why. Even the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur has to fill the Aron with the Anah, with the smoke of the Ketoret. Right? I think there's a reason why the Torah takes these golden statues and puts them into a context where we can understand them intellectually but not physically see them and relate to them and involve ourselves with them. They take the Aron out of the Kodesh HaKodashim, all that falls away. All that falls away. Right. So that's the beginning of the story. There's a couple of pieces of the story that we haven't yet addressed. The whole question about taking the Aron into battle, did they or didn't they? Quote that I shared with you at the beginning of in Bamidbar. So if they did, what was so out of the ordinary here? If they didn't, so what did they usually take with them into battle? That whole question, which is a major discussion in the sources, we will look at Bezrat Hashem next week. And then on top of that, we have to ask ourselves, does the punishment fit the crime in the sense of the resulting destruction of the capture of the Aron, the destruction of the Mikdash? What happened there? Was it just the trap of having handed the Kruvim over to the pagan Plishtim, or was there actually something more going on within the camp of Israel? That's something which we will, Bezrat Hashem, address in the next couple of weeks.
Does the art scroll, has it translated in the singular? This one translates it in the plural, but it says art scroll has it in the singular. That's
as what?
I noticed that too.
Did you see
that?
What?
It just says the Hashem.
This is the God who struck the Egyptians, and who will save us from the hand of this mighty God? Isn't that weird? And this one has plural. This
that's
one
unbelievable.
Has